Contrary to popular wishes, this podcast is coming out to you almost a week late.
Oops. What happened? It wasn't my fault.
Apathy.
a mix of apathy and genuine illness. So I apologise ahead of time if you hear us coughing. Graham, we'll try and edit out the worst of the sniffles. We aren't terrifically well, as you may have gathered from the quietness on the website. But we are doing our best to drag ourselves out of our pits and record more for you. We couldn't possibly let it go a full week late. This is Season 2, Episode 18 of the podcast. I'm Paul Hudson, more or less.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Mike Saunders.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Kill him!
It's that guy. Who everybody hates.
Run away! Don't forget, you can subscribe to Linux Format at tuxedradar.com/subscribe. There are lots of great reasons. And actually, to prove some great reasons, we've picked off three random people from the street to ask them who've never seen Linux Format before today what they think. And the first person here is called Mike. Mike, what do you think of Linux Format?
It's got big penguins on the front of it, which is always nice because
that must be great.
I've got a pet penguin, you see, so I just assume it's all about penguins.
Wow, yeah, you should subscribe. Second person, Andrew, why is Linux Format so great?
Well, because the issue that is on sale next. Oh, I've not seen it before, have I?
No.
I had a premonition.
Yes?
That the issue that's on sale next will be a split-run cover.
What? But what does that mean? That's a publishing technical term here. You're a publishing geek, remember? What does that mean?
It means that there's going to be that's going to be KDE... No! It means that one magazine is... If you're going to WH Smith, you should be presented with a choice.
Choice is good.
Of the Ubuntu version or the Fedora version of the next issue.
Yes. So we have regular meetings inside Future Decide what to put on our covers. And I know no one cares about them, but we do. And our cover line was chosen by this clinic. And to make it equal, because it's Fedora versus Ubuntu, which isn't really, but that's what the line says. There's another version, Ubuntu versus Fedora. So you can buy either a blue one or a purplish-orangey one.
Or both. Or both.
Yeah. Keep us in drinks, and depending on your allegiance.
We couldn't make our mind up which was the most awesome, so we just had to do two covers.
It's true.
I wanted Slackware versus Debian, but nobody listened to me, so never mind.
It's a shame, because it costs money to do this. We could have had one of those nice holographic covers instead. Yeah. I want one of them one day.
We could have had a pay rise.
Nah.
What does that mean?
And Graham, why is Linux so awesome?
It's got the world's best review section.
Written by that guy that everybody loves.
So no, it's actually nothing to do with me, which is why it's so great.
So that's why I subscribe to Linux Format at tuxedradar.com/subscribe. Meanwhile, in this episode, we are talking... possibly Magaia, depending how you pronounce it. At the same time, LibreOffice and Android lawsuits again. We report back on the results of our text adventure challenge.
Yay!
Yeah, perhaps more less yay and more meh. But never mind. And of course, our regular sections, Discovery of the Week, plus our In the Hot Seat. This time it's Graham Morrison, everyone's favourite. And our open ballot, where we ask the question, is Graham Morrison wrong?
Yes, I am.
You've spoiled it now.
You can just turn off now, listeners.
But this podcast, before the news, I want to bring a very special section. Because we've been away for a little while. I had a 2-week holiday in Hungary, which is where my wife's from. And the first half of the holiday, I was online. The second half, I was offline. Mm-hmm. So I got to read the initial responses to our last podcast while I was online. I read the first 6 or 7 responses. And I only saw the rest of the responses when I came back, and the first several were quite depressing. I was actually really upset and depressed, and I thought, that's it, I've had enough, I'm going to give up this job because I'm sick of reading this kind of thing. And people were saying, you know, I have over 4 years of LF magazines on my shelf, listened to all the podcasts, and I've found the level of cynicism and contempt for the opinions of parts of the community that have developed over more recent issues and podcasts is just astounding.
Well, that guy's just talking nonsense.
Listened to the podcast yesterday on my way home and wish I had not bothered. It was really quite depressing. And only when I got back to the country did I see all the rest of their responses and people saying, no, they're wrong. Thanks so much, guys. You work so hard. It's really awesome what you do. And I felt encouraged again. And, I had 3 or 4 days to sit and think about what we do at Linux Format, and we get so many negative responses. I tell you a fact that you do not know. I tell you this for a fact. We spend $500,000 a year paying people to make Linux content. Padfoot, what do you do?
Yeah.
Right? I spent every working day of my life thinking of ways to tell people of how great Linux is.
Yes, this is what we do.
Mike spends his days remastering Linux distros. Graham spends his days finding reviewers or writing features or all sorts of things. Really, we try as our whole lives making this stuff work, passing on the good news. We're evangelists for the Linux faith. I know we're cynical. Of course we're cynical. We use it every single day. But we want Linux to succeed. We really honestly do. It's in our business interest to make Linux succeed.
Yeah.
If it doesn't succeed, we have a job. But at the same time, we really honestly care. You know, Mike here is a hardcore OS coder. Graham here is, sadly, a KDE fanboy, so it's very grave. Me, I write lots of free code and give it away, and Andrew here has made some of the best games known to man. haven't quite seen yet.
That's not that good.
We really care, and, you know, these kind of comments aren't helping. And what really struck me as very sad was when someone said how often we run Ubuntu/Mint on the cover disk. And I realised at some point, and I get the Ubuntu hate. People say, you know, Ubuntu's popular. I don't like popular. I hate Ubuntu, basically.
Counterculture.
And at some point, Mint, a different distro, which, fair enough, is based on Ubuntu with their own changes and stuff, has been lumped in with this Ubuntu hate. I mean, now they hate Mint too. Now he hates Mint too. That's really very sad.
Just hating by proxy, because it's something to do with Ubuntu.
Yes. So anything Ubuntu spin-off like Mythbuntu must be bad because it's based on Ubuntu.
It's got Untu in the title, yeah.
It does, yeah. When did choice become so bad? So a small spin-off for you, just have something to think about. You know, we really, it's our day jobs making Linux work, and we spend an incredible amount of money paying people to write Linux stuff and write it ourselves. So it is depressing and sad, but to read these kind of things. But fortunately, we had so many supporters say, thank you very much for the work we do. So it's not too bad, and there is still hope for us all.
No, we do appreciate that. Yeah, when people leave comments saying, you know,
we really do. Thank you so much.
It makes this feel worthwhile.
Yes. And with that...
Yes, and with that, thanks, Paul. It's the news section.
Uh-oh.
In fact, there has been quite a bit of news.
Hooray! I like these late podcasts.
Yes. First, is the difficulty of pronouncing the new Mandriva fork, which I'm going to go for Magia.
I thought Magia.
I thought Magia.
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 Of course, the French intonation. Yeah.
Is it a Norwegian name or something like that? I did have a quick Google for it, but couldn't find anything on what the...
No, I mean, I think it's a bit of a bad start when you come up with a name that people are arguing about how to pronounce.
Yeah, I think so too. On one of the mailing lists, it said, it's very difficult to describe exactly how to pronounce it. Let me send you a WAV file.
Oh.
Anyway.
In true tradition, to be fair.
Yeah.
It is great that Mandriva isn't being allowed to die a death.
That's great. Absolutely.
It is going to live on in the form of this new distribution, which seems to have lots of contributors from the original release versions working towards this as well, and it's going to keep many of the good things.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. I've been following the mailing list of this, and maybe there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood, but the mailing list read a bit kind of trivial, really. There's huge discussions about code names for the cooker branch. There's, you know, 60 post thread on what color of a certain icon and things like that. So I'm hoping there's actual code and packages and infrastructure being put in the background, because the mailing list at the moment looks a lot like any hobby OS project that starts up with them dealing with the trivialities first.
Do you think there could be Ubuntu fanboys who've signed up to the mailing list and are just trolling?
Yes.
This icon should be red.
Maybe the entire thing is set up by Ubuntu fanboys. And the distro itself doesn't exist.
Wasn't the community was always one of the great things about Mandriva?
Yeah, it was very, very helpful. Mandrake community. Users who really stuck together and posted a lot of messages. Really, they advocated their distro and they worked together. So.
And I think that's one of the main motivations behind the fork, is that they've realised that the community is so strong and can hopefully carry it forward enough. I think as long as they've got quite modest demands and don't expect the fame of perhaps Ubuntu, I think Mandriva can live on quite strongly as a distribution. You know, there's still some great parts to it. The configuration panels are great.
Well, that's it. I mean, I was thinking about what makes Mandriva Mandriva, and I was wondering if it's actually necessary to start a whole new distro project with all the problems that entails as well. I wonder if they could take another distro and Mandriva, if I add the Mandriva control center and hardware detection that's really good as well, and, you know, integration with the online services and the forums, perhaps, this will get me flamed to death, but perhaps they could take another distro, take Debian or something and do that and still have the Mandriva goodness and then reduce the packaging duplication.
I don't see why not. Well, a lot of distros come to KDE second. They do the GNOME polish first and then do a Kubuntu release or whatever, or a Fedora KDE release. Whereas I'll have a go. Was it Magia? Magia?
Magia.
Magia? Okay. We're all different. Hooray. It's one of the few distros which always put KDE first. Yeah. And so had a great KDE experience out of the box. And I think that alone makes it an important priority to preserve it and enhance it as much as possible.
Yeah, I can't say that my KDE experience with the last Mandriva release has been all that great. But they did do some innovation. They're fast booting Mandriva off the USB sticks, and they've done the instant on stuff, which has been really good. I mean, that source code will be valuable and could be a valuable contribution to the community.
Mm.
And next, we've got another fork.
Wow.
Is it the time of year?
I've gone forking mad.
It's LibreOffice, which is a fork of OpenOffice, a fork by something called the Document Foundation.
Yeah.
Which I don't really know anything about.
These are a bunch of guys who want to basically move OpenOffice away from Oracle, given Oracle's less than popular behaviour in recent months.
Months?
Well, yeah, that's even more of that. It's the Document Foundation is a self-governing meritocratic foundation by leading members of the OOO community. They're forking OpenOffice to try and make it freer and less tied into corporate interests, but also really good. They're taking in the GoOO branch improvements as well.
What, so it's the same number of forks of OpenOffice at the end of the day, or is that?
So GoOO will continue?
I don't know, but presumably they're still working this out, but they are taking in their version.
Is Michael Meeks involved with the LibreOffice?
Well, I guess he will be. I don't think so directly, but I guess he will be by proxy if they base their branch on GoOO. Yeah. And GoOO's got lots of cool extra features, and those guys work really hard on things like performance.
Yes, yeah.
And stuff, you know, as much as you can improve the performance of
it's
that.
It's still flogging a dead horse, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know they're a lot faster.
So the negativity begins.
You've got to be realistic. I've got the mission statement here of the Document Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
Our mission is to facilitate the evolution of the OpenOffice.org community into a new independent and meritocratic organizational structure within the next few months. So we should get that. That's fast for OpenOffice. We're going to actually see something before Christmas.
Yeah, that's very corporate market speak, isn't it? They could probably wear that to get it out of the hands of Oracle.
Meritocratic is such an empty word. Do you think, is there any organisation on earth that would claim to be not meritocratic?
The Labour Party?
The rubbish people, we let them be in
charge. that's a good point. But OpenOffice does need to start developing quicker and be more responsive to things.
Perhaps this will help, like when X forked.
Maybe
386 to Xorg.
It doesn't have the same venom and pith, though, does it, as that fork was? That this is kind of OpenOffice isn't really going anywhere. What should we do?
Isn't it a fork to keep it safe?
Yes, well, it's always safe. I mean, we could use the same source code in 10 years and no one would know the difference. Anyway, another.
When we record season 10, podcast 18, or whatever, we will come back to this point and ask you how it's doing.
Yep.
You may well be right. Let's face it, you probably are.
Let's make a point of trying that.
Wrong.
The state of OpenOffice.org or LibreOffice. Another negative, forks aren't negative, but there's a negative story now is Microsoft is hitting Motorola with a patent lawsuit over technology in Android, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this Microsoft are claiming that Motorola infringes upon 9 of its patents. And here's a quote. A range of functionality, including syncing email and notifying applications of changes in signal strength and battery power. Wow.
The quote I really like best is that it's from the Deputy General Counsel for Microsoft, who says, the Microsoft innovations at issue in this case help make smartphones smart. Now, I've used Microsoft smartphones, and I'd never call them smart.
The old Windows Mobile 6.x looked horrendous to use. So
yes.
Fiddly with little styluses. Who wants a stylus? And,
Hang on. I'm not very clever, so I don't understand. Microsoft owns the patent for the idea of telling you your battery's getting low.
Of telling an application
applications.
That your battery's going low. So you could run Andrew's battery checker program, specially made for your phone that you've bought, and then it communicates with the operating system to find out what level the battery is like. Yeah. And now Microsoft owns your rear. So
like XFC power manager, something like that.
Yeah, basically, the queries the operating system to get power information.
But on phones, that's a difference.
That's clever.
That's how patents work.
They're driving innovation at all levels.
Yeah. Well, this is what patents are about. You invent something 40 years ago, it then expires, you then reinvent it on the computer. And now, because they've expired now 20 years further on, same thing, on the internet.
Yeah. Wow. In the cloud.
Yeah, so it keeps on going. But there's an industry here.
Why do we... I'm broadening this away from news, but as good citizens of the European Union, why do we care?
That's a good point, and we have talked about this in the past, and I think really the EU should become a stronghold of innovation. You know, leave the Americans to fighting over
these
patents.
They'll be left behind.
Google come over here, everybody else come over here, Motorola come over here, and, you know.
We do have software patents in the EU, but it's not legal.
Mm.
It's great.
Yet.
Cool.
We have them. They're issuing them still.
Yes.
They shouldn't be, but they are, which is fantastic. So it's worse than the US, I think. At least they've got a very clear view over there.
We're just wasting time, as usual.
Yeah. And the EU is currently travelling around the world trying to convince the rest of the world to stiffen up their patent laws, so we've got an excuse to do ourselves.
Yes, yeah. Did you see that story of Will Stormin in Australia?
This is how it works. Again, with copyright, what happens is... copyright being a European thing originally, let's say, okay, let's have 20 years... The Americans have done 20 years, and we have 30 years. That's more copyright than theirs. And the Americans go, well, let's have more than theirs. 40 years, 50 years, 70 years, 80 years. And so it's now something like life plus 110 years, or 90 years. It's really, really, really long, and the Europeans want to make it even longer.
But I might plan to live that long, you know, in fairness. Yeah.
What, 110 years? 110 years after death?
Plus my life, yeah.
Hello!
I'm not dead.
Like, it's so cool.
Yeah. So it's going to get longer and longer and worse, and the EU's got no chance, so these EU guys are very clear. Anyway, it's another anti-Android patent, which is worrying, because I've had another
one. Surprise.
Do it seem like these companies are assuming on other relatively small things, small cases, are putting out the feelers just to see exactly what can be done? I still see this kind of massive cataclysmic patent war appearing at some point where everybody dies.
Well, I don't think it's small things at all, because it only takes one patent to render Android non-free.
I guess actually, yeah.
And with Motorola... If they, they're a small company in Google, if they admit liability, then Microsoft can go ahead and tap other people. Not, interestingly enough, HTC, because they make Windows phones.
Right, yes.
So they went to Motorola, people don't care anymore. I think they maybe used to make Windows phones, not anymore. So they can get them good, like Sony Ericsson, they're going to get them one of these days, I reckon. Admit some liability, they can go and pass it on to someone else. They haven't gone straight to Google like they could have done, which Oracle did.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it's not looking good for Android.
No, it isn't, annoyingly.
Well, yes, but it was inevitable, I think. You know, there's so much technology in Android and so much technology that we've seen in other places.
But it's interesting, who else is going to sue next? Why, Apple presumably owns a vast number of patents in this area.
Yeah.
Hasn't budged an inch. So.
But I do agree with Mike, there'll be this massive storm of patents fighting over all of these companies, and they'll all have to come to some kind of arrangement.
I want Microsoft to sue me, because I'm sure I violated some of their patents in macOS. Due to the fat file system.
But admitting it and still doing it's worse.
Uh-oh.
Knowingly violating patents is worse.
I didn't know when I wrote the code, honest.
Too late now.
Right, and our last news story is the dawn of a new image format.
Yay!
Which
choice is great.
Which we know is pronounced Webby.
Webby, isn't
it? Yeah. But it's spelt Webp. This seems to be an offshoot of Google's Web.
Why can't they just call it Webby then?
Why on this one?
It's so that you can see it.
Yeah, calm down, Andrew.
It's obviously part of their movie technology that they're now using for still images.
It is. It's VP8, isn't it?
Yes.
Image codifying stuff. But yeah, it's lossy compression for photos, and you know they claim it's a lot better than JPEG, and they're trying to sell the business case of this as well, saying, you know, if you have a big website and you're serving 20 trillion photos per day, you know, this will reduce your bandwidth costs, presumably, if Flickr moved over to Webby. And everybody had the right plugins to view it. There is a library. They've made a library. They have made libwebp, and so you can start implementing support for it in your programs.
I mean, I think it's a good thing. I mean, I'd rather... There's Google sitting on the technology. They've obviously got this fantastic image encryption algorithm. I mean, compression algorithm. Mm. You know, why not stick it into its own codec effectively and make it a free format? I mean, I use Ping for most images, but large JPEGs are essential to the internet.
For photos, yeah,
exactly.
Why not? Because some tests show it to be worse than JPEG?
Well, if that's the case, I haven't had a chance to do any side-by-side comparison.
Yeah, and also, the idea isn't new. I mean, JPEG 2000 is available to use. Yeah. A number of, you can already create it in Photoshop or Photo Paint, or even the GIMP can do JPEG 2000.
Mm.
Same sort of deal.
Yeah, yeah.
No one used it. MS also had their own attempt to make a JPEG replacement.
Yeah, bitmap.
No, <that's laughs> better than JPEG. Definitely better than JPEG. And of course, they're in a position that always were at the time to say, okay, we're going to roll it across all our Internet Explorer browsers. Suddenly, 3/4 of the world can use it, you know? Still didn't take on. So, good luck, Google.
Well, if they make it, embed it in Chrome, lots of people using Chrome, Chrome OS, Flickr automatically recognizes that you're using Chrome. Yeah. You know, I can see it saving bandwidth for them.
I guess the previous example of this was Ping versus GIF, wasn't it? When I started using the web, Ping didn't exist, everybody was using GIFs.
And yeah.
You know, now that's changed considerably, and Ping's relatively well-supported format, isn't it?
Yeah.
Still miss animated GIFs, though. Oh. No worries.
You can make them in the GIMP.
Yes.
Yeah. Bring back animated GIFs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ming never caught on, did it? Multiple network graphics.
Was that the animated Ping format?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Right.
Never caught on.
I know, you really missed those.
I think Gecko Sports are
under construction animated icons on GeoCities websites, don't you?
So, yeah. So, there's a command line tool, WebPCOM, for converting your JPEGs, and it's going to be in future versions of Chrome.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still in development, apparently.
Yeah.
To make it better.
In perpetuity. Yeah, whatever that word is.
I'm going to fork it.
In perpetuity.
Yeah. Give it an even more crazy name.
Mike-em. Mike-em. Mike P.
Mike.
Great. And now it's time for You Dare Us.
They Dare Us.
After which words on the piece of paper in front of me, some wag has written the initials AG, which means I'm in charge of it.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So it says here, we all make a text adventure, and then some more words.
Right. I did.
So how was your text adventure, Mike?
I used GNOME Inform on the recommendation of Graham.
Now, this is because Graham did a tutorial on, or a project, wasn't it, on GNOME Inform?
He did, for Linux format. He showed how to use GNOME Inform. GNOME Inform lets you make text adventures by using natural language. So you say, like, you know, the pig is in the cellar, and the pig is edible, and then people can type commands into that. But actually, I didn't actually follow Graham's tutorial, I've got to admit, because I couldn't find it. But what I did find was when Graham covered the program in our Hotpick section, and I used his screenshot as the basis for learning how the engine works. So thanks, Graham. My adventure, my text adventure is set at a Linux expo. And you go in through the front door, and if you try and leave at the start, you're not allowed because you haven't properly geeked yourself up. So without wanting to give too much away, what you've got to do is before you leave the expo, you've got to get back to that door and show that you are a proper Linux geek by acquiring certain things and trading certain things and going to different stands and bits and bits
really?
Like that. Yeah.
Well, you've added all that into it.
Yeah. It was a bit hard work because the documentation is very thorough. I mean, Paul will have a good talk about this in a minute, I'm sure. But the documentation is very thorough, but it's quite hard to find clear, simple examples at some point. But otherwise, I think if I was going to spend 6 months with it, I think I'd really learn to like the capabilities. It's incredibly powerful. You can set up whole machines that, you know, you press one switch and it activates 20 different things and you end up carrying stuff on your head and things. So I had fun with it. It's my adventure is only very very small, but readers can play it. So.
What's it called?
Our Linux Export Adventure.
Mine sounds much, much smaller. I started off with trying to create an adventure of a penguin that was on an iceberg in some ice floe somewhere, but I gave up because it was so frustrating trying to carve a story without having to spend hours and hours and hours learning how to work. So I then came up with a very small adventure called GNU is not a room.
Ooh.
And really all it is that you're in a room, and when you go north, east, south or west, you end up in the same room. That's it.
How recursive.
That's it. I enjoyed playing text adventures and still do occasionally, but I don't know. I just couldn't get over that initial hurdle.
Is it free software, you asked? Does it respect Richard Stallman's freedom?
I hope so. And, you know,
send it to him.
I think he'll find it frustrating playing it as I find his acronyms frustrating.
So in my game, I made a game, Murder in NXF Towers.
Whoa.
And it's set in NXF Towers. At least what you think it might look like. And the idea was to find out who killed Mike.
Oh,
could it be anybody?
It could be anyone. It starts off, you're in Mike's cubicle. Mike is here. Mike is dead. Let's try and figure out who did it. Sadly, I realized very quickly that I'm very poor at GNOME Informs natural language. I find it very, very hard to use, which is silly. It's natural language, right? It should be very, very easy to use. But actually, I find that it's so natural, it doesn't actually suit the way I phrase things. And as Mike did hint on, the manual is wonderfully comprehensive.
Mm.
It's got some cracking examples to do some really powerful things, but very few examples of how to do very simple things.
Yes, exactly.
So I really struggle with the basics, you know, using objects, giving things to people.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, you're right.
So when you meet Andrew, he is in the LXF petting zoo.
Okay.
You meet him there, and I wanted him to give you a key. That took me. I had to actually ask Mike for help. Mike, how the heck do you give things?
And I'm dead.
To characters. I just couldn't do it, so I eventually asked Mike. So it was very, very hard. And the end result is the game is only half finished. Fortunately, it's open source, so you can go ahead and fork it and add an ending where you find out who killed Mike. But it's good because you get to come to visit the podcast recording suite.
Hey.
Oh, we've got a podcast recording suite.
Is that where we are now? where are you now?
I'm in some strange office somewhere.
And you can go and visit that, and you can have a go at spinning our wheel, which is quite cool.
Hey.
You can go to the LXF Amiga Appreciation Room.
I love that room.
You can go and visit Nick's cellar.
Oh, don't go in there.
No. So I didn't enjoy making it. I found it deeply frustrating. Because I just didn't understand, and it is basically a programming language.
Well, it is. This is another problem as well, because it tries to be natural language, and sometimes that works wonderfully well. But what it does is it always encourages you to just try writing more and more stuff when you know you're going to fail. So you think, okay, hand the key over to the guy if he's holding the thing. Yes. Nope, fail, yeah. Wrong. But it looks like it should work, you know.
At the end of the day, you need to know the exact syntax.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had the same problem trying to create a manhole cover that was a door. You know, because you know you can do it because you've seen it in other adventure games.
Yeah.
You say the manhole cover is a door. Doesn't work. It creates a problem. The manhole cover is below the room. And then you created a room description called the manhole cover with exit south.
Oh.
It was something like that. Anyway, it wasn't obvious. And as Paul said, there are no simple examples for just how to use rooms and objects. So you could create a very complicated interaction with a manhole.
There were some cracking examples, though. I remember there's one about rope. So I was thinking of having some sort of rope involved, pulley. And it was an example of where you could use rope, and it was like, you know, a rope is a thing that can be tied to something else, was the description. A non-rope is something that is not a rope. And it always starts with these list of Lewis Carroll style premises, 10 long, to explain the world you're working in, and then eventually you get to the stuff that matters, you know. Understand spinning as the action spin with past participle spun.
Oh,
okay. Okay, I'll go with that. All right, I had to do this because I had to spin the wheel, you see. So I had to try and get and I got a light switch to work temporarily, then get rid of it because it wasn't actually very good. And it also, I couldn't find a way. I wanted to say this room is dark. You must have like a torch or flashlight to see in the room. You cannot move in the room when it's dark. How do you do that? Come on, it's a fairly common thing to want to say. The room's dark. Can't move. Nope. If you know, go south, you walk right through the dark room to the other place.
So, yeah, I've got some conditions in my code. If the player, you know, has X or Y, then let certain thing happen. Otherwise, don't.
Yes, but I've got some of them too.
Yeah. But like you say, yeah, the lack of examples. Perhaps what we should do is gather together some of the things we've done and put it into a little game and give it to the developers and say, you know, just put this as a generic, simple example to set people off without having to read all the hard stuff.
Not my game. We can't use that. It'd be terrible.
No. Well,
it sounds like you've really got the gist of it, actually, Mike. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I think, like I say, if I had a lot of time, I think I could actually spend time making something more of it. It was frustrating in place of the reason Paul mentioned, but I did start to learn to like it in the end.
You have to admit, if you do understand the grammar, you can do anything with it. It's very, very powerful. Mm. You can almost rewrite the rules from scratch, and that's amazing. But we are at such a junior level to that, we just got nowhere at all.
Yeah. Yeah, we gave ourselves just a couple of weeks.
Treading water, you know?
Yeah.
I couldn't even play it. who was the chap who sent the game to us?
Kevin Collier.
Yeah.
He sent the game. Torvalds is dead.
Oh,
right.
Which you get to play me. And have to release a new version of Linux. That's the goal. It's actually the best game.
You have to patch a security flaw.
It's the best game. I haven't played Mike's, of course. It's better than mine. Graham reckons it's better than his, or it sounds like it's better than Graham's anyway. It was really good. He seems to have used quite a number of advanced features from the thing. And he said he had to. He was struggling to get it as it was, which is amazing because it's far better than ours. We'll put it online so you can have a look at it. But yeah, respect to Kevin because it's great. Right, you, Andrew, did you?
Well, no, I tried playing Kevin's, but I'm sure you go into a room and there's a window or a whiteboard or something.
There's a whiteboard, isn't there?
And I said, I can't remember what it was. Like, rather read whiteboard or look at whiteboard, and it said there is no such object in the room, because I'd got the syntax wrong, and I could see in the same screen that there was that object in the room. And I just got really frustrated with it and thought, if I can't play it, then I'm going to have no chance at all of actually making a game. So I read through the source code and found out how it ended. it's probably really bad, but it was. I quite enjoyed it anyway. It was quite cool.
Enjoying software through the source code, is that a new...
It's weird, isn't it?
I'm going to go and read gimp.c, see what's going down.
Really entertaining. So for the next challenge,
yeah,
I think we've come to the conclusion we deserve a break, quite frankly.
Something a lot easier.
The Texas Adventure thing was really properly brain-melting.
Mm.
So for the next 2 weeks, we're not going to do any sort of challenge whatsoever. And also, I think it's only one person agreed to do the challenge with us. Thanks, Kevin. You're awesome.
Kevin's great.
The rest of you,
you're
rubbish.
Yeah.
Try harder.
What were you thinking?
We're going to have a break for 2 weeks so we can relax.
Sounds great.
Sit in the balmy tropical weather that's around us right now.
Yeah, look at that.
Tumbleweed.
Those howling monkeys. Brightly coloured parakeets.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks, I guess, with more challenges, presumably.
Hoo!
And with such wonderful holiday plans, we come to the halfway point of our podcast. This is going to be a long podcast, you know, guys. Still to come, our discovery of the week. In the hot seat, this time it's Graham Morrison. And our open ballot, this time it's Graham Morrison.
Positive and negative Graham Morrison.
Oh.
Cancel each other out.
Good cop, bad cop. All right, it's discovery of the week. And I'm going to start with a couple of things. I found two cool things, or two interesting things, or one thing that's good and one thing that's not quite so good. The first one is zombieurl.com. Has anybody seen zombieurl? This is like tinyurl. So you put in a fully in website address like linuxformat.com, and it gives you a shorter version, zombieurl.com/blah.
Yeah.
And then if you go to this, the Linux format site appears, but after 5 seconds, a massive zombie face appears in the middle of the screen. So feel great. Free to use that to give people heart attacks. Of course, general mayhem.
Make a scream sound at the same time.
I don't know, because I never have my sound on. It might actually do that, but it's pretty horrible because it's a full screen, horrible flesh mutating zombie. Right, it just smashes right up in the middle of your screen.
That would be really cool with the let me Google that for you thing as well. So you could send it. You could use the tiny URL of the let me Google that for you with the zombie, so that as the URL's typed. Forget it.
Oh, you're right. Probably string these things together for maximum lulls. Yeah, so have fun, listeners, and let us know what kind of jokes you get up to with that. The other thing I discovered was you know, here we go, something slightly negative again, but I installed Ubuntu 10.10 Release Candidate, and I installed it in British English, and there I saw the trash icon in the bottom right corner of the screen. So I right-clicked it, and it says, open the wastebasket and empty the deleted items folder. Are those two separate things? There's a wastebasket and a deleted items folder. Okay, there's two things. And when you click through, it says rubbish bin. Why are there three separate names for exactly the same thing?
And is it called trash on the desktop?
It's called trash
on
the command line, where it stores. So you've actually, in total, got four different names. Now, what's really annoying is that this was reported as a bug in July 2009. So it's been over a year of this ink. I know it's not a big deal, but it's just kind of one of those 100 paper cuts type of things that should be sorted out. And, you know, it would confuse my parents. Looking at that. They would say, you know,
isn't choice a good thing?
Exactly, yeah. But, yeah, I hope they sort it out, because it will make people reticent to report bugs
if they're
just going to be left and delete them. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, one fun thing and one not quite so fun thing. But these things should be talked about. So, Graham.
My discovery is that the Alteo online virtual desktop is actually really good.
Whoa.
I had cause to install it and configure it. And it's not the live distro or any of the normal downloads you use. It's actually the online virtual desktop is actually the cloud desktop version. So Alteo actually will sell you their own remote servers with their with the desktop running on, so you can log on to your own KDE desktop. But you can, it's all free and open source software. You can actually download the server part and the client part and the management interface. You can install them all on Ubuntu. You can get them running on your own network and create your own KDE sessions effectively inside a web browser from a machine on your own server. So it's a bit like remote desktops, like VNC, but it's super efficient. You can manage it and maintain it all from a web interface. And it's really, really impressive. It's all open source. And it's amazing what Gal Duval and his team there at Alteo have been able to accomplish. I'm very impressed.
Well, that's what I was going to say, of course. Yeah, Alteo was from the former Mandrake guy, Gal Duval. And I remember you, Graham, actually writing a feature on it probably about 3 or 4 years ago.
Well,
now,
back when we didn't really know what it was. Yeah. It's still vague. I mean, I think they've got a problem, a marketing problem, because they've got lots of different versions of Alteo.
I was actually surprised that it kept sticking around for so long. Do you think it's something like who's an idea whose time has come now that we're getting used to cloud computing and connections are getting faster and we're all
connected
everywhere?
If I was running an internet cafe or even a small business or even a large business, I would definitely look at it. You know, because you need you need something that's capable of opening a browser. Effectively, and you could get to a desktop, do anything in the desktop. It's all extremely locked down. You can enable a terminal access through the OVD if you want to, but that's all limited through the administrator's browser console. So you could just enable GIMP if you want to, people can just use the GIMP on their PCs with a full screen browser interface. And it's just a no-brainer way of doing it. I really like it. I really like the way it's centrally managed and in the cloud if you want it to be.
Cool. Kudos.
There should be a new version out probably in the next few months because they base it on Ubuntu LTS releases.
Oh, well, it must be evil then because everything based on Ubuntu is evil. Yeah.
You can install it in Fedora too.
Paul?
Despite having had many weeks since the last podcast, I have discovered nothing of importance. However, I have discovered some useless things.
Cool.
Which I'll share with you anyway because I like reading Wikipedia. Firstly, it's a topic that Mike very much seems interested in, which is games take a very, very long time to play. I discovered Journey to Alpha Centauri in real time, which takes 3,000 years to complete.
Cool.
That's awesome.
That's great. What consoles is it released for?
You want to buy it now? Go to the shops.
I'll leave it running on my old Game Boy or something.
Yes.
Hand it down to my children.
Well, that's your plan to live forever. You may actually get there. And obviously, it competes with, is it Desert Bus?
Desert Bus was the Penn and Teller game. Yeah, you had to ride a bus across the desert for 8 hours. And you had to hold down accelerate. But you couldn't just take the button down because the bus would always steer slightly to the left. You had to keep correcting it. There was no pause facility or anything like that. And I just while we're getting a bit off topic here, I heard a story that they submitted this game to Sega. It was for the Mega CD. And because of the way Sega operated, like Nintendo, they had to play test the game through fully beforehand before they could actually sign it off and release it. So some guys at Sega playtesting department spent all night spending 8 hours playing Desert Bus. But then once you got to the end, you had to drive 8 hours back as well. So they spent 16 hours on shifts with all sorts of Coca-Cola and things, just playing this ridiculous joke game.
Well, you can say that. It's actually, people are still playing it. It's used in for a charity now.
Desert Bus.
Yeah, people have events where they'll do like 35 runs. back, forward, in shifts. And apparently they've said there are variations. After about 3 hours in, you'll see something whiz by on one side.
Yeah. You're awake. After like 5 hours, a bug hits your screen and that's it because there's no other scenery. And there's nobody on the bus. You've got a rear view mirror and it's just empty. And if you hit the side of the road, you have to wait about 20 minutes for a tow thing to come, and it tows you back in real time. So if you've gone 4 hours the way, it'll just tow you back for 4 hours.
So that has now been bested by Journey to Alpha Centauri in real time.
Does it always veer to the left? The spaceship veer to the left.
Other discovery, I didn't realise this, the music from Xenon 2 Mega Blast was the basis from the Assault on Precinct 13 by John Carpenter.
Whoa! Yeah.
Listen to it. It's absolutely true.
Do they pay for it?
That's the riff there. That's the riff. That's the bomb the bass. took it from there. And finally, I discovered this just last night, well, this morning about 2 a.m. The Amiga 600 cost more to make than the Amiga 500.
Because it was so compact?
Which was entirely the wrong plan. They planned to make the same thing, just cheaper. And they ended up making it more expensive.
Is that because it was more compact?
Well, they changed a lot of the components as well. The things inside it were slightly different. So there's they killed like fast RAM, for example, and they added different chipset, wasn't it? Slightly different chipset.
I thought it was about the same as the 500+.
They changed the soldering as well. They monkeyed around with all different things.
ECS, the extended chipset in that.
Yeah, and they were basically aware it was a complete disaster. That's why it lasted a year.
Idiots.
It lasted a year, did it? I had an A600 before I got a 1200, which
92, 93. Yeah, I know. Well, I see people complaining, obviously, from the very beginning. They couldn't play Railroad Tycoon properly because you couldn't make diagonal tracks.
Really?
It was very annoying, wasn't it? You couldn't do it. So I missed that on my 600.
Ah, the Amiga.
Great discoveries.
Lovely.
Sweet.
Shannon to you. And well, Andrew?
My discovery comes from the murky hinterlands that sits between computers and real life.
Whoa, I've never been there.
And that is that I went go-karting at the weekend, and I discovered that the racing lines that you use in F-Zero don't work in real life on go-karts.
But... That's what I base my entire life on.
Well, when you get a driving license, Mike, you find out that it's not true. I thought I was the pink car, the one that goes really fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that I was
always the pink car.
So
yeah.
I was going around corners trying to keep like taking a really really wide racing line, thinking, well, that's okay because if I stay at full speed, I'm faster than everyone else on the straights. But of course, I wasn't. So I was just being really rubbish at corners.
When you went off the track, did you explode like in F-Zero? In Fireball?
Only a couple of times, yeah. Right. It was a wet day, so the flames were quite subdued.
Cool. And was that music playing in your head all the time?
I was expecting like speed boosts and stuff, but it just depends on your actual skill. So I was clearly at a disadvantage.
Oh, man. I hate it when something requires skill. It always gets in my way.
There you go. Computers in not real shock.
Uh-oh.
It's now time for our In the Hot Seat section, which is us, Graham Morrison, because we love Graham so very, very much. For this time, we're going to be spinning the wheel in my text adventure. just wait. Go south. Go west. Spin wheel. Ah, it looks like your topic is grub.
Grub. Excellent, excellent.
Does that still say wheel is spinning?
wheel. See my screen? Let me turn that around. Okay, so the actual answer is... Audacity.
Ah.
Graham, you have 2 minutes.
Two?
Potentially. 1 minute. Graham, you have 1 minute to talk non-stop about Audacity. You know the usual rules. If you stop, we will mock you intensely. Are you ready?
Let's get mine. I can look at yours, can't I?
Yes. Are you ready?
Okay.
1 minute. Commencing now.
Audacity, for those that don't know, is an audio editor that lets you trim and tail web files and make them smaller. Now, a while ago, I gave Audacity a terrible review in Linux Format magazine. It must have been about 4 years ago. I really didn't like it because it was slow and clunky, and it really wasn't intuitive, much like the Windows WAV file editors were at the time. But I'm happy to say that over the last few years, it has vastly improved. And I've even edited the podcast on it because you can do multi-channel editing, which is something almost no other audio editor does. That means you can have the four microphone feeds from our four microphones all in parallel, all at the same time, and you can cut and trim bits where Paul says something wrong or where Mike swears. And it really works well. So these days, Audacity is probably one of the best audio editing tools you can get. It's available for Windows, for Linux, and for OS X, and it's free.
Well done.
When you were heading towards the time up there, I heard you going through operating system. I thought you were just going to use it and NetBSD and WiscOS.
MicOS.
So are you saying you've actually run the podcast through Audacity?
Yes, that's true, yeah. Well, if I have the time.
Some editing goes on.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Graham is positive, deep down.
Does that mean Graham might not be wrong?
We'll find out, because next is our open ballot.
Ah.
An exciting question.
I've heard about this.
In which Graham gets podcast lynched. The question, so basically, Graham wrote a column for our sister magazine, PC Plus, which was then reprinted in Tech Radar, an online brand run by the same company. And adjusted just slightly, to be fair. It wasn't exactly the things he wrote. And they gave it a new title, which is The Trouble with Linux, There's Too Much Choice. So there was immediately a bit of a spin on what Graham said. So that's just to put things into context a little bit. But his general point of view was that there is a great deal of choice and it can be confusing. In response to that, Caitlin Martlin on the O'Reilly blog responded with the question, are you intimidated by breakfast cereal? She contended that Graham was completely wrong. So our question was to you guys, is Graham on the right track? And is it confusing to have so much choice, or is he wrong? Is it like having choices of breakfast cereal? And we've had many responses. Mm. It's been quite a passionate discussion. And that's why I think it's very important to put into context at the very beginning. Graham has used Linux for a very long time, and he's very technical in that respect.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting.
He's not a troll.
Firstly, it's very interesting how much passion there is in this particular argument. But before getting into it, I still stand exactly by what I said. And I'll respond first. Firstly, I'm not going to criticise Caitlin too much for what she said. But the problem that I was trying to address, it was for a general PC crowd. I was assuming most people had tried Linux and moved back to Windows. Because I do think that Linux has failed on the desktop. And the problem I have is Caitlin is saying, are you intimidated by breakfast cereal? I think the problem that most people have when they come to Linux and they don't know anything about it is they don't understand what breakfast cereal is, and they cannot distinguish between the different varieties of breakfast cereal. They don't even know why there are different varieties of breakfast cereal. Over my years at Linux Format, I've taken a great many phone calls from people who use Linux and have used Linux for the first time. And what they nearly always ask is, what is GNOME? What is KDE? Mm. And fair enough, I can tell them what GNOME and I can describe in terms what GNOME and KDE are, but I can't describe them in any way that would be meaningful to those people who have just started Linux. And that, I think, is a massive problem. And I think it's maybe the biggest reason why Linux has not succeeded on the desktop, that we missed the Vista opportunity, we missed the OS X migration opportunity, and why I think Linux is still failing on the desktop. It's a great success in lots of other areas, but that was my point.
Well, there's a great quote here from... firstly, I think Caitlin actually misconstrued some of what you said. Her response was a great response to a point you didn't make. If you made the point, we should start killing off software, no, you're not allowed to work in FSupport anymore, no, you're not allowed to this, then her response is fantastic. You didn't really say that.
That's not what I was saying at all, actually.
Exactly. So I don't think she got quite the right argument. But anyway, she made a wonderful point here, and it's worth discussing. Windows still holds between 84 and 89% of the market, and is a de facto monopoly still. Considering that 2 years ago, they were somewhere around 95%, it is clear that Linux is growing nicely despite lots of factors stacked against it. Which is an interesting point to make, because I think it rather excludes the fact that Vista was widely known to be a complete disaster.
Yeah.
And it rules out Mac OS, which seems to be growing remarably quickly right now.
Well, this is the thing. I read a piece, of course, and the arguments she had with people, and she was claiming that she had all the statistics right and everybody else was wrong. But the source I looked at is Wikipedia's own statistics page for access.
Oh, yes.
In June 2010, the number of people using Linux to access Wikipedia was 1.88%. Now, even if you be very optimistic and you know, assume that some people are spoofing their browser agents, which I really don't think happens anymore, then you're looking at 2% tops like that. So
that follows in with how we feel as well.
That follows in how we feel. And I would like to echo what Graham's sentiment as well about, he's been on the phone listening to readers. I run the Linux Smart website and I'm always on the help forum and I read everything there, and I see a lot of people massively confused. They try and read a tutorial and they're confused because it doesn't apply to their distro. They don't know why there's so many package managers, and Caitlin's denying all this. She says that's not a problem. She's looking at the Linux users she knows, and she's happy with Linux, and that's great. But she's got to look at the 98% of people who don't use Linux and ask, why is this the case?
That was who I was addressing.
Yeah, and I can see this. I can see why people get frustrated. So when she denies that it's a problem, that is just denial. She should go and spend some time on phones and look at why people are not using it. There's a huge amount of silent people out there who've tried Linux, got completely confused by the fragmentation and the duplication of effort. And
just 2 weeks ago, I had this exact conversation with someone who just bought Linux Format and just installed, I think it was OpenSUSE on the disk, and his questions were exactly that. For 45 minutes, we're generally happy to do, but it was, what is KDE? What is GNOME? Which shall I try? I don't know. Choose one. Which application should I use to manage my photos? I don't know. Digicam? Well, that's falling out of favor. You know, F-Spot? No. Shotwell? Well, you know, what do you choose? How will I listen to my music? How can I sync things to my iPhone? How do I manage my phone files? How do I create a website? How do I edit documents?
And then they go and try and follow a tutorial, and it's like, well, in Ubuntu, you'd click here, why? But in SUSE, you've got to go to Yast and stuff. It's a real problem.
We all love choice. But that's after we've already got over that initial hump.
Well, that's I think one of the problems that Mike faces every day is that when we try and explain to someone how to install software, and this is a point Graham made directly, he's been there for 12 years now and he's not familiar with it. And he doesn't mean he can't install software. That's the wrong way to construe this. Graham can install software in 10 different ways. He knows how to do it. The problem is, if I say, Graham, I'm using Slackware 13, how do I install software? You may not know.
No.
Yeah. Or if we're writing in a magazine or in a website, how do you install, I don't know, SDL? A very, very common game, probably the most common game library on Linux. How do you do it? Well, you might use RPM, you might use Synaptic, you might use apt-get, you might use Ubuntu Software Center, you might not use none of those things. You might use Emerge.
Who knows what you might do?
You might compile open source. You might call SDL dev, SDL devel.
Lib
it may not be in there whatsoever.
Yeah.
There are a number of different ways. That's why I personally think, in the wider respect, choice is great. I want choice to flourish, survive of the fittest, all that kind of thing. But I believe at the same time, there are a number of areas where the choice is causing damage to the community, damage to our chances of success.
Absolutely.
Now, if you put to one side that for a second, you believe, actually, screw success, I don't want success, I like it the way it is, that's fine. But if you want Linux to become a major desktop market player, which it is not right now, then things like package managers are not where we need choice.
Mm, yes.
RPM is not really evolving very much.
Yeah.
Neither is APT. They don't change that great deal. So why can't we just say, listen, obviously we know our features. Let's try and unify a little bit in these areas. Then have photo editors. I don't might agree so much with Graham in that respect. Have photo editors, as many as you want, by the dozen. Do you like? It just means it's cross-compatible to some respect.
Yeah.
Which is a big difference.
And the same for configuration tools as well.
Configuration tools, another thing, yeah. So if you said to someone, how do you configure a wireless network? Well, I end up saying, if up, if config, you know.
This is so different between distros. That should not be the case.
Yes. Right, so let's have a look at what some of our readers said. Penguin, DNW, said, clearly Graham is right. The BSD wars proved that too much choice will kill market adoption. And even more to the point, Ms. Martin is the obvious winner, because if large IT vendors have taught us anything, competition is the only way to avoid the vendor lock-in boogeyman. So I say, everything in moderation. Choice is good in choice is good. Good answer, Penguin DNW. Yes, Graham Morrison wrote something childishly simplistic and got his pants flamed, says Penguin Poop. For that reason, this comment detracts from the quality of available Linux offerings. His main example, Shotwell, is like the figurine in the cereal box. Nice to have, you like that kind of thing, but not why you choose that brand of cereal. Am I the only one who found the cereal analogy a bit silly?
It's completely nonsense to compare operating systems with cereals.
There was a chap responding to Caitlin's blog saying that, who extended the cereal metaphor, saying, well, it is confusing, but only if Cocoa Pops only work with semi-skimmed.
Yes,
and Frosty's only works with full fat, and if you use the same bowl for both, then it just breaks and it turns into poison,
and you've got dependencies.
Yeah.
Upgrading the milk level doesn't result in all the corn suddenly disappearing.
That's the one.
That's quite true. I've never had any cereal crash.
Yeah,
but also you know what cereal are. You know what they are. You know what they give you. You know why there's a difference between them.
I don't have to say, Graham, I've just got this new cereal. How do I put it in my bowl?
What is the cereal? Why is the cereal? Why is cereal?
I never get flamed online by porridge fanboys either.
You might now.
Yeah.
You might now, yeah. So, obviously, argument by analogy is somewhat wonky in the first place, but this particular analogy I'm not sure really holds up. And she does go in to say that it only holds up in the desktop user space, but not in the server room. And she seems to have a bit of a conflicted view here, because she argues that most web servers run Linux, which I find, I hear this quite a lot, actually. I'm not sure why I hear it a lot, but people seem to like giving me a statistic. And I say back to them, well, let's break that down slightly. We know that 55% of servers run Apache. Mm. So I wouldn't say most, I'd say a slim majority run a free web server. But how many of them run Linux? I don't know. We use Mac OS X here for our big sites.
BSD.
Or occasionally Solaris or BSD, is a massive choice. I do not believe that most Linux web servers run Linux.
I think it's got a really good, healthy, check the market, 20-30%
Big. It's the biggest.
Yeah.
But in the Linux space, but I don't think it's a majority by any means. And particularly given that 25% definitely run Windows because they're IIS.
Yeah.
It runs nowhere else other than Windows. I would say Linux is probably a fraction ahead of that.
I wonder if you can run IIS on Wine for the lulz.
Yes, possibly. She also doesn't say, usually she just disagrees whatever people respond to, which is great. But she says, I've not found these problems to be true. With any of the major distributions, I can run pretty much any application I want. The only exception I know are those designed for the enterprise.
Hey,
that's great. That's our major market share, and that's where the problem lies.
That's where Linux should be trying to go. That's really
realistically, she says also in another comment, a new user is not going to choose from DistroWatch. They will use whatever is preloaded, or if they install it for themselves, what is popular, or what is recommended by a friend. So realistically, the DistroWatch list is irrelevant. Interesting.
Yeah, but there were some people in the comments making this point. They were saying that the number of distributions available is not a hindrance to Linux adoption. But by market forces alone, if you step back from this and you think of this in terms of giving someone an operating system as a consumer product, then they're completely wrong. If you take an example of a product that launched recently that was popular, the iPad, what these Linux users are saying is if Apple had launched 100 slightly different iPads with all slightly different ways of accessing the configuration panels and they all had slight different incompatibilities and they all look slightly different, then it would have been even bigger success. No, it would have been an absolute disaster if people had walked into a shop and seen 100 different iPads. It would have failed massively. Now, fair enough, a lot of people only hear about the top 5 or 10 distros, but if Apple had launched 5 or 10 slightly different iPads, they've succeeded because they've unified around one product saying this is the product you want. Now, there are different arguments to be had about whether the iPad is good or bad, but the point being is if we're trying to sell Linux to people as a consumer product on the desktop, it's got to be a unified, cohesive experience, and the more distros doesn't help that at all. I understand people wanting choice and everything, but if you stand back and look at this from a business perspective, those arguments are completely wrong.
And I think you're right. I think the main problem here is that the initial column was talking about Linux growth, wanting Linux to grow, whereas people are critically responding to me reducing their freedom or thinking that I'm saying, no, we shouldn't have a choice of Firefox or Chrome. We should just all have Chrome. It's not saying that at all. It's a bit like the command line thing that we talked about in the last episode. We weren't talking about removing the command line. It's simply that for Linux to grow and for growth to kickstart growth again, I think somebody needs to make big decisions like this and create what Steve Jobs has done in the iPad and to a lesser degree in OS X. Somebody needs to make an executive decision. We're all free to do everything else.
I really loved the quote from Adam Williamson from Red Hat. They're on Fedora, 12, 13, 14?
14. Yeah,
but with Shotwell, it was 13, I think, was the first one.
Yeah. 13 is interesting.
He explains why they dropped F-Spot. It wasn't because of Mono or anything like that. He says, we found F-Spot was very slow and buggy when dealing with large collections of images. And this was in there until version 12 Fedora, which was launched after version 9 of Red Hat. 20-something versions, and they're still stuck on slow, buggy software? Maybe the current solution is not working.
Interestingly, I spoke to Steve George from Canonical this morning. He's their VP of Business Development Services, and part of the conversation was that he'd heard about this FlameFest
you
online.
You are so infamous.
And while I didn't ask him to pick sides, he did say what I think encapsulates the argument. He did say what people really want to do is they just want to read their email, they just want to browse the internet, they just want to write a document. They don't care what it is that's doing it. They just want to do that as quickly and as easily without any kind of pre-knowledge, as quickly as easy as possible. And I think that's the point. I think that's the main point. I think maybe Ubuntu are trying to do that. Maybe that's why so many people dislike Ubuntu.
Maybe. Well, this is why I think we've had competition web browsers across all platforms for a long time, and it hasn't caused a single problem, apart from there's an issue now where some companies have made IE6 intranets, which rely on IE6. But generally across the web, things just work.
Fail.
Things just work.
And for a long time, it didn't. It was very frustrating. Yeah. As a Linux user, it just didn't work.
Yeah, but because they're around a standard, they all work in roughly the same way. They all do roughly the same thing. And that works very, very well. Whereas you find with Shotwell or F-Spot or, let's face it, the 200 other photo albums we've gone through in the past several years, of which you've written one yourself.
Contribute
to the mess, you know.
Yeah, and part of the problem with that I think I've talked about before, is that me and the Digicam developers couldn't agree on a standard meta information format for the photos. We just couldn't agree, so we just agreed to disagree.
Excellent.
Either that, or I just do what Digicam does.
Yeah. Well, what it means is that we're stuck with having to explain from scratch again how to use new software, right, with no actual gain. And no one has to explain how to use a web browser, do they?
No.
Went to Facebook or Twitter or whatever you want to use and get Facebooking. So what are we saying? Is Graham Morrison wrong?
Graham's right.
He's wrong.
Are you just saying that for
force of habit, I'm afraid.
So he's saying that in the office every day.
Well, yeah. Susan says that he's wrong.
Susan Linton of Disco Watch.
Susan Linton.
Tux Machines.
On page 38.
Nearly everybody online says I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But then they're not asking, why has Linux only got 1.88% market share? When you ask that question, you realise, Graham, you might be onto something. That's the big... Everyone who doubts what you're saying, right, ask yourself, why is Linux...
Well, do I hear a very convincing argument why he's wrong?
Okay.
Mr. Morrison is wrong. It's as simple as that.
Great. I'm convinced.
Is he thinking at all?
No. That's what my mum used to say to me.
Are you sure that wasn't your mum posting that?
Graham is a beautiful specimen of humanity and cannot possibly be wrong about anything, says Hugh.
Now thanks, we know Hugh. Your girlfriend.
I like this one from MJCPK. 6 of 1 and 0110 of the other. Both have taken a black or white stance on it, and Caitlin seems far too fired up about it for any rational debate. I would agree with that. Again, I would just remind you that Graham's column was repitched by Tech Radar. You want to read it in the context of PC Plus. Poorly made, but a good point is a good point. Here we have a person who is willing to stick his neck on the line and tell us what he thinks. The fact they're prepared to give him a hard time for doing so is despicable. Actually, I do agree with that, because there are a number of times in responses to this where people like Caitlin use the word arrogance because Graham had an opinion. Great. I know she's a software consultant, and that's a very important job, and it's great that she's working hard to promote Linux. Graham works very hard as well to promote Linux. He's a big Linux user, a big Linux fanboy. He's written software for Linux. He does his podcast. He writes about Linux. You know, I wouldn't say it's arrogance for him to have formed a view. It's not really a short-term view either. He spent 12 years forming this view.
Exactly, yeah. I think, everybody gets passionate in these debates. But Caitlin accusing people of being like Microsoft shills and things just for arguing the points, I think it's not healthy for the discussion at all.
No. We have many. There's many from Anonymous Penguin. Guys, if you don't use your name, we're not going to read you out. It's much easier.
Yeah, it's difficult putting your name to an opinion, isn't it?
Never want to do that again.
Ed Vim, which I think is a bit of a joke coming up here. More choices will win out in the long run. I can see there are valid points with that too many distros argument, but taking all the good and bad aspects into consideration, I still think more is better than less. There's never going to be an absolute winner in this argument. Both options have varying and evolving strengths and weaknesses. I tend to see diversity as being the primary factor in breeding inspiration, experimentation, innovation, and competition. Monocultural thinking is more often than not the antithesis of that. Well, I don't think anyone's saying we want monoculture.
No, absolutely not.
Monocultural thinking.
It's the opposite of that. I'm talking about a unified front end, you know, a unified face for new users, for unified, people to recognize as Linux. I think the competition that has led to the desktops that we love and the choice that we all like to make about what our favorite applications are must survive. And open source is part of that movement. But in terms of Linux growth, there needs to be some rationalization.
That guy's not thinking from a business sense, is he? He's saying, all these choices will drive us through, but he's not looking at 1.88% market share after 10 years of talking about Linux on the desktop.
So when you buy a car, you don't care whether the engine has 4 or 6 or 8 cylinders, or whether it's diesel or petrol, or whether there's what size the engine is or anything like that, but you do want a steering wheel in a recognisable place.
Yeah, and the pedals in the right place.
The pedals in the
right
order.
Always in the right place, whatever car you get. And that's not the case with Linux distro.
And some means of making it slow down, whether that's... And
you know, leaf spring suspension, individual. I don't know. I've gone beyond my car knowledge.
Oh well,
you had me at steering wheel.
I thought
you
said carnal knowledge then.
That too.
I think it'd be really good if there were four different names for the gear stick. Good luck trying to find it.
Sometimes the clutch is in the middle. Sometimes
it's on the right. It's on the right. All right. Pantsless Penguin says Graham isn't complaining at how many choices there are out there. He's complaining the choice hasn't been made for him. But also, when Fedora and Ubuntu drop F spot in favor of Shotwell, he's mad because the choice being made for him wasn't the one he wanted, which apparently amounts to a loss of freedom. So, which is it, buddy? Which is
yeah,
it, buddy?
Graham. And maybe the Shotwell F spot point wasn't the strongest.
No,
argument. But the point I was trying to make was that it was a changed standard. I just wish they'd stick to one thing. You know, I just wish that if they just wish they'd stick to one thing. Fine, if they're going to stick the Shotwell for the next 20 years, fine. Help make it better, because at the moment I think it's pretty weak.
Actually, it occurred to me recently that the major downside of open source software, for free software in general, is that the result of choice is that whenever you have a new distro or a new photo manager or whatever, you have to come up with a new name for it. And that's how we end up with G-Scrot. I think it's a terrible comparison in this respect, because obviously Apple owns its software completely. The Apple movie software is called iMovie. The other ones are iDVD, iTunes, whatever. Right?
iScrot, yeah, for the screenshot tool.
Or it's Windows Movie Maker.
Yeah.
Windows Photo, yeah, whatever, yeah. Right? And because there's only one of them, they get the name right. And it's not very difficult to use, yeah? You know, whereas on Linux, we have this wonderful merging of things where it doesn't say Shotwell. It either says Photo Manager,
yeah,
forget
yeah.
the branding, or Shotwell Photo Manager in brackets to help you remind what it is. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what it was.
That's interesting, especially in the case of iMovie, where they effectively completely changed the application.
Yes,
same name,
different
iMovie. Application. Yeah. And has compatibility and works in the way that you might expect it to if you use the previous version. I'd like that. If Shotwell,
they're very clever.
Yeah,
Someone said to me once, there's no such thing as the old iPhone. It's only the iPhone and the new iPhone. They're very good with their branding.
The iPhone you want.
Yeah.
There's the iPhone you've got, the iPhone you want.
Rakio said, make your first choice and the rest follow. This is true, actually.
Yeah.
Say you pick Ubuntu, that means you get GNOME, Debs, etc. If you went for Ubuntu, it's KDE and Debs. No other choices are necessary. Pick Mandriva, it's KDE and RPMs. Well-supported distros offer a wide variety of packages, so you'll likely find the package you want in a native format. Not after warrant using Alien with Debs on Mandriva. This is true. So make one choice, it kind of follows from there.
That's true. If you have a JPEG on your desktop and double click on it, an application will open. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what that is. You could do it the other way. You could go through, you know, applications, sound and graphics, and then choose from the list that appears, or you can double click on the file. And
GwenView will let you crop that image and change the contrast and do other things with it, whereas the GNOME preview won't.
On the other side of the geek scale, we have Morten Yule Johansson, Green and White, who said, to be fair, I actually do find the cereal line in my local store intimidating.
Poor bloke.
Yeah, it's a hard life.
Must live in the US.
But as a Slackware user, I would hate to be locked up in some auto-magical hell of a distribution making decisions for me. That's true.
Me too.
That's true. Ratter says, I wouldn't like to be stuck with GNOME or KDE. Fair enough.
Yay, XFCE.
XFCE for the win. Graham is correct, says Al, in principle at least, having dabbled with Debian many years ago and decided it was not usable as a desktop operating system. I returned to Linux over the past 12 months, using Ubuntu exclusively since May. The biggest problem he had was a vast choice of applications for any particular task, with no real guidance available as to which would suit me the best. Following the links in the package manager sometimes leads to a fantastic website full of user information, other times not so much. I'd agree with that, because when I do searches in Synaptic, it returns the results to me in some sort of random ordering system, often by default using description and name. So if I do SDL, I'll get loads of results, not any idea which one I want to install, it's a bit difficult to use. Fortunately, I know which one I scroll through. I just waste a few minutes scrolling through trying to find the right one, or change the search criteria, or add some more letters to it, or whatever. But I couldn't imagine my parents using that kind of thing.
Never, never.
Actually, I remember my dad first got Linux on his netbook. The first question was, I've got Skype from the Skype website, how do I put it on there? I was like, okay, let me just check the file you've got, and it was an MSI file. Like, you can't use that. And we took a long time trying to get Skype working. It was very, very painful. And he's now switched to a Mac. Not on my recommendation, dude. Did it by himself. There were loads of responses. It was lots of responses, and it's great to have so much discussion. But I don't know. They all seem to be saying, I know what you're saying. Some of them are really, really long. Some are quite hateful, actually. Some are really angry.
Yeah, I didn't read them.
Don't let them change. There are lots of good people in the world as well as these zealots. Yeah. Don't worry. These bile-spitting zealots.
I remember that phone call you took last week, Graham, and one of the questions you asked him was, have you used a computer before?
Yeah.
Do you think...
He actually was very technical. At the end of the day, he picked up everything I said very quickly. He'd used Windows for a long time. It's just that some of those questions that he was asking at the beginning, I wasn't sure how much he knew, in what kind of answers to give him. So at the very beginning, it was like, what's the difference between GNOME and KDE? Have you used a computer before? Yes. What computer did you use? Windows. Well, you know how Windows looks. You know how the applications behave. Well, that's a desktop environment, and GNOME and KDE are two.
That's the thing. From Caitlin's response, when someone said, listen, I have this big problem, she's like, I don't have that problem.
Yeah.
Okay, I get in your consulting business, probably for businesses, I presume not consult for home users, they have a different set of problems to the ones our readers face. Mm. We get many, many calls from readers that start with, I'm 72 and I've just installed Linux. Firstly, that's fantastic. It is awesome people are experimenting with Linux.
Mm.
It's doubly awesome they're doing it when they have so much spare time. They've retired. Experiment. They could do anything they want to, gardening or traveling the world. They've chosen to have fun with Linux. That's fantastic. Go have great fun. We want to help you and support you. We then hear, I just don't understand, blah, 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 blah. I cannot do blah, blah, blah. My networking doesn't work, blah, 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 blah. They have many, many problems, and these are problems that Caitlin doesn't experience. We hear from them every single day.
Absolutely, yeah.
Our answers column in the magazine is filled with problems every single month, more than we can print going to the magazine every single month. There are many, many problems, and I think it's important to start facing up to them. We're not being cynical about this. If you want to come in and do our job for a day, you're welcome to give it a try. Yeah. We'll forward you some of the emails. Have a go. Help these people. Talk in our help forums. Mm-hmm. People have very serious problems with Linux, and ignoring them, saying, I don't have those problems, isn't going to work. They really come to terms with the fact that the level of choice we have is causing issues. And in that respect, I really think Graham is absolutely right. As he said, the F-spot point was, I think, wrong.
Quite badly made, yeah.
Was badly made. But more generally, there is an issue of the fact that we do have quite a high burn rate of applications, I think. You know, things like CD burners on GNOME.
Oh, man.
You know, I still think GNOME Baker's in there somewhere. photo albums. I don't understand why these two are such hotbeds of incredible development, with all the wonderful new features we're now doing.
But that's where you start, isn't it? If you're a programmer and you want to get involved in the open source world, it'd be really boring to just fix some bugs in someone else's program. So you go ahead and make your own, which, you know, you can't stop people doing that. But it'd be nice if a lot of time people had a bit more restraint and said, you know what, I'm going to focus my efforts on making this program better instead of making yet another source project.
That's up to the distro makers not to include every last thing.
That's
their discretion. Their job is to do that. They have to. It's the difference between the internet and a magazine. There's so much stuff that we could put in Linux format, and we use our knowledge to edit that and pick out the best and most relevant.
That's the point, yeah.
I don't really want restraint. I want people to go ahead and write the stuff they want to write. I think it's down to the distros to be very careful in what they choose and only jump ship when they really have to. And the fact that they claim F-Sort was very buggy and slow and all these things, well, why are you shipping it in the first place again? You know, why? Shotwell isn't exactly a particularly advanced program.
No, it looks pretty basic.
So what took so long? You know, what happened there? And it's not even the first switch they've made. So I think it's a bit of a confusing issue right now. Anyway, I think we better pull this to a close because it's the longest podcast ever, I think.
Yeah.
Mm.
Graham, you're half right.
Thank you. Thanks. I expected you all to give me a hard time, actually, so...
But we all agree with you. I feel pretty good
about that. Well, different levels. You know, I think choice is good still. But not in the area of standards. I think the LSB, RPM, APT, S is sick.
Edlin, frankly.
It's just sick. It's wrong. Anyway, I look forward to hearing the many comments on this in the comments. Don't forget all the notes for this podcast.
Oh, wait, quick, I know this is the longest podcast ever, but we must have a quick one more thing. If I have a one more thing anyway. Oh yeah, because we were talking about Maggie IUEI before. Quick question to test your Linux knowledge. When was the first Mandrake release? And what number was it? What was it code name?
1994, and it was version number 1.
Wrong.
No, 98.
98, correct, Graham.
And version number 5 or 6?
5.1.
1? Yeah.
Yes! Why would you start with 5.1?
Because it was based on Red Hat 5.1.
Red Hat.
And could anybody remember the code name?
Sorry, go ahead. No, I don't remember the code name.
It was Venice. Oh,
right. We met Gael Duval ages ago in Paris for an interview, and he said one of the most awesome things. He chose the name Mandrake because he wanted a name that sounded a bit like Red Hat. Yes, would you have guessed this? English was not his first language.
I remember that.
He's such a nice guy. He really is. He's really technical, really creative, and very friendly. And that quote will always live in my memory.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast. Don't forget all the notes, once Graham has typed them up from the Flame War, will be on the website. And we're looking forward to reading your comments. You can email us. Email address is paul.hudson@futurenet.com. Once more, kudos to Kevin Colley. We'll put your game online. Please enjoy it. Try all our games, apart from Andrew, who's done the game like usual. And don't forget to send all your flames to Mr. Morrison directly. Mr. Morrison.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Hudson.
Bye.
Ciao.
Bye.